From the studios at KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that's accessible, interesting, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Several weeks ago, I was a passenger on the Seabourn Quest, a state-of-the-art cruise ship that called on ports in the North Sea. While on board, I had the opportunity to tour the bridge, meet officers, and also sit down for a conversation with the captain of the Quest, Bjarne Larsen. Our first segment is a taped interview of that conversation about the technology of the Quest and a life at sea for Captain Larsen.
Good morning, John. Is that a way for me to vicariously experience your recent vacation?
Yes, it is. I have pictures also.
Thank you. That's really nice, because I was stuck here. Our second guest this morning is Dr. Andrew Shapiro. He's the manager of the Early Stage Innovation for the Space Technology Office at the California Institute of Technology Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL, where he's currently responsible for several technology tasks for potential Europa lander missions. Now, it's Europa, of course, is one of Jupiter's 16 moons. It's a mysterious and icy moon that we will hopefully explore soon. Dr. Shapiro will tell us about the unique technologies needed to explore the moon Europa.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. The Epic School Kids program gives all children across the state of Utah from kindergarten through fifth grade 5 days of skiing plus 1 day rental and lesson. More information at parkcitymountain.com.
Miller Orthodontics is a proud supporter of The Randy Barton Show. Since 1988, my wife and I have provided a combined 45 years of orthodontic care. For our Invisalign patients, we provide digital scanning and imaging technology that eliminates the need for wet molds of your teeth. More information is at m2ortho.com.
The following interview was taped May 13th on the bridge of the Seabourn Quest in Copenhagen, Denmark. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. For the past 12 days, I've been a passenger on a cruise ship that has called on ports in England, Belgium, Scotland, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. The ship is the Seabourn Quest. She's 8 years old, 650 feet long. Her beam is 84 feet. She weighs 32,000 tons, and she carries 450 guests and 330 crew members. I'm very pleased to be joining Captain Larsen on the bridge of the Seabourn Quest, where we've just docked at the city of Copenhagen. Captain Larsen, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wells. I'm very happy, and I appreciate that you have invited me to your show. Thank you very much.
It's been a great couple of weeks, and I've enjoyed this cruise very much. You know, many people believe that a ship's bridge would contain a wheel, a compass, maybe some engine controls, and they'd really be quite surprised to see the bridge of the Seabourn Quest. The wheel's been replaced by a joystick. The technology likens this bridge to a mission control space launch, maybe a Star Trek bridge. For our listeners who have not had the opportunity to see a modern ship's bridge, can you describe the technology here before us?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, when just to start with a wheel, sometimes when we have guests visiting our bridge, they are expecting this old-fashioned big wooden wheel, and there you go. We're having a plastic wheel of $10 and on a ship that cost maybe hundreds of millions of dollars, right? So, times has changed. It's 30 years ago since I started at sea, and things really have changed since then in terms of the technology on board. In terms of all the electronic aids that assist us and help us during our navigation in open seas and in port, it's a huge aid for us, and it has really improved the safety of our navigation, also collision awareness with other ships, and you get a predicted course on the ship, on our radars, And so it is a huge, a real huge help and aid for us to carry out a safe navigation on board. Having said that, we know all that electronic can fail, and it can not only give an error, but you can lose it completely. And that's where the experience, and where you have to do it all, where you're back to normal manual steering of the ship.
Yes.
So it's still important to look out the window and see what's going on. I mean, it's like when you're driving your car also, you know, it's you are reacting yourself to the conditions. If you have eyes on the road, if it is very windy, and things like that. And that's the same for us. We have still to react on the outer factors that are reacting on the ship.
And the ship's technology has backup systems that have backup systems, is that correct?
That's correct. So if I'm gonna lose one radar, then I have another radar. Actually on the bridge I have 5 radars, and we have also electronic CMAP with backup systems. So all our equipment on the bridge has backup equipment, and also if we lose power on the ship, we still have a power for the most essential things on board, among our electronic navigation aids on the bridge.
And you have the capability through GPS to be able to pick out a point or a series of points, and the navigational system will take into consideration wind and current and be able to take you to that point?
Yeah, we have a system, a track pilot system, where it will calculate the drift of the ship, drift force made by wind and or current, and then it will steer perfectly. And again, it is very reliable, but you still need persons on the bridge to monitor such automatic track of the ship.
And how many officers are on the bridge at any one time?
At any time we have never less than 2 bridge officers on the bridge. So we have 1 senior officer and 1 junior officer, and then we have 1 lookout. So there are 3 persons up there all the time. And then that is during normal conditions. If we then are getting into higher density of traffic, if we have poor visibility, there can be different circumstances that then force us to step up. That means we are getting 1 extra officer on the bridge, a senior officer. And then if that is called yellow condition, and then the condition where we have most people on the bridge is red condition, and that's where we have either the staff captain or myself on the bridge, which is in circumstance like when we go to port and from the port, then we are always in red condition, fully manned on the bridge.
Exactly. Well, as a sailor of much smaller boats, and I mean I would sail very, very small boats in comparison, I've noticed that some of the ports that we've called on seem to be challenging to navigate, and this is, again, a very large boat. Can you tell us or tell our audience what a pilot is, what is their role, and who has command and control during this pilot phase?
Yeah, so a pilot is a person from the port that we are calling who have a lot of knowledge and experience from his local waters. So he knows those waters like his own pants, as we used to say, and he's coming on board when we're approaching the port, and then we go through some checklist with him, and then he's assisting me as captain in navigating the ship to the port. He's never taking the command. I'm still in command, meaning that I have full responsibility. I can give him the con, meaning that he's the one giving the direct orders to the helmsman. However, I can always overrule his command or his orders since I'm still in command and it is my responsibility.
Okay.
So that's how it is all over the world, except from the Panama Canal, which I mentioned that to you the other days, that
yes,
that they are it's different over there.
They are responsible when they get on.
It's a bit different over there, yeah. But that is how it is, and you know, it's You meet a lot of people in that way that has many years of experience. Most of them are former captains, and you know, in some places there can be a language barrier, and if you get out to maybe the Far East, or it can be South, or it can be places where maybe English is not that much used by people, and there can be sometimes mm-hmm. a challenge to communicate, which is of course very important.
Now, the Seabourn Quest has 10 upper decks above the waterline, and she draws the draft as something, I believe it's 18 feet, roughly 18 feet. So on the port side and the steer and the starboard side, it can act like a sail, can't it? It's a kind of a flat bottom boat with a lot of a lot of surface to the wind.
Yeah, no, that's true. And you know, Mr. Wells, it's funny that you have this subject now. We just left Helsingborg earlier today, and the pilots in there, they actually recommended me to turn the vessel inside the port and then steer straight out. That's fine. Again, the pilot, he knows the port, he knows the waters, but I know the ship better than him. So I said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to back out through the breakwaters, because I know that this ship will seek the wind.
Yes.
Like on any sailing boat. Because this ship with slow speed, she's like a sailing boat. So she tries to go up the wind the way that you are heading, in this case with the stern. And she did it. She came beautiful out, and I was hardly doing anything except going astern.
Well, I noticed that you hugged the jetty on the starboard side and left yourself extra room on the port side.
Yeah.
And I figured that was because of the wind, because the prevailing wind was coming from the stern.
Yeah.
And you, if you stayed tight to the starboard side,
yes.
If there was any movement, it would be to the port, and you yeah. gave yourself extra room. Was exactly. that what happened?
Exactly. As soon as I saw there was an opening between the breakwaters, that's the time I just say, okay, guys, now we go astern.
Yeah.
And it's funny because the pilots, they actually told me, but Captain, we have only tried this maneuver in a simulator. Okay, I said, well, now you're going to try it for real.
Yeah, well, I was looking at the channel, and I was watching what you were doing, and yeah. it's a challenging, there was a challenging
was.
Spot you were in.
Yeah. And yeah. that maneuver, of course, had been going through my head since we had challenged due to strong winds. So of course, during the day, I have been doing this maneuver mm-hmm. several times in my head.
Yes.
Before I executed.
Okay.
And the same this afternoon when we came in, it was still windy, and I approached the berth with the wind in the stern to avoid drifts on the ship. So.
We've had a little bit of weather on this cruise, and I know that you've been very busy in all of your assignments and everything. This is an assignment as a captain on the Seabourn Quest has to be very challenging. How long are your assignments? What is life on board for a sea captain? How often do you get to go home?
Well, normal contract is 3 months on board, plus minus 14 days,
mm-hmm.
And then I have the same period at home, around 3 months, before I return back to the ship. So
yes.
you can say basically we are two captains sharing the ship. One is home, one is on board.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how it goes. And you know, being a captain on a cruise ship is it's a big honor, you know. It's like as a sea captain, I would say that is the ultimate goal in a career for any seaman who are interested in becoming an officer. And I've been working on cargo ships where there are only a few people on board, and you don't have the same social life on ships like that. I mean, here you have a lot more people to mingle around with, you to talk to, and I just love my job being captain on a cruise ship. And of course I'm proud to be captain, especially on Seabourn, because it is a high luxury cruise ship. I love part of what I like is, you know, I walk around the ship. I make sure that our health, environmental, safety and security policies are followed during my daily inspections. I make sure that I reach out to our crew, no matter if they're officers or if they're working way down below in the laundry or the guys who are peeling the potatoes, I like to be out there to everybody and make sure that they are happy and that they are doing their job well. So.
Well, you certainly have the respect of the crew. They feel that we are all in good hands.
Thank you
under
very
your
much.
Under your Thank control. You. I also understand that your grandfather was a fisherman and that he first introduced you to a life on the sea when you were approximately 10 years old. Can you tell us about that and tell us about your grandfather?
Yeah, my good old grandfather. Actually, he would have turned 100 this summer if he was still alive. Unfortunately, he passed away 20 years ago. He was like a father to me, and I came often down to the port, of course, to be on his fishing boat, and he told me many stories about the seaman's life, and maybe not all of it was true, I don't know, but it was very good stories, you know. And so I've always got, I grew up with the sea in terms of he was the fisherman, and it was always my dream to get out. And yeah, actually in the beginning I wanted to be a fisherman myself, but my mom, she told me no way, you know, because at those times the safety was not as it is today for the fishermen, and many of them actually never went back home from the fishing fields. So she told me, no way, it's not going to be a fisherman. If you can go to sea, but then you're going to take an education as an officer. And I agreed, and you know, here I am. So thanks to my mom, but also thanks to my grandfather.
Well, Captain Larson, I want to thank you for the bridge tour yesterday and the opportunity to meet your officers and to understand how this very sophisticated boat operates. And just thank you for being on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you and to join your show. Thank you very much.
From the bridge of the Seabourn Quest in Copenhagen, this is John Wells, Cool Science Radio, over and out.
That was a really interesting interview. Good stuff, John.
Oh, thank you. He was a fascinating man, and the ship, he runs a tight ship, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was just reading an article about pirates on the high seas, and with a boat that size, there's not, I mean, do they safeguard against pirates? Is that an issue?
We asked him about that, and he said that the international community had done a pretty good job discouraging pirates. However, they pop up every once in a while, and he didn't go into any specifics other than he said that he had people that could deal with that in a very capable way, and that they had what he called toys that they could deploy that would keep the boat and the passengers safe. He didn't go into any more specifics, but I'm going to tell you something. I'm sure he had some toys, all right.
That's right. And then on a boat that size, I've never been on a cruise ship, but it's about 30-some thousand tons.
Yes.
And what about, you know, you're on the high seas, they're rough. Do you feel it? Do they have some method for smoothing the ride?
We were out in gale force winds one night when we were crossing the North Sea, and it got a little bumpy out there. And they have various technologies that they use. They have a lot of weight on the bow, which is the front of the boat, which keeps the front of the boat from slamming down. They also have these hydraulic stabilizers that are in the port and the starboard stern, which is the left and the right back part of the boat. And they put the stabilizers, these hydraulic devices, in various configurations based on the type of waves that they're getting. And also, all the refuse from the boat goes into a device that turns it into gray water, and they have these bladders throughout the boat that they fill with the gray water, and they fill the bladders in various parts depending again on the waves to add weight in certain areas to again stabilize the boat.
Wow, fascinating. You know, we've talked about boats a couple of times on Cool Science Radio recently.
Yeah.
And just a couple weeks ago, we spoke with Park City resident and Chief Information Officer of Oracle, Mark Sunday, who talked to us about the Oracle boat America's Cup, which began last Friday, I believe.
Yeah.
I haven't checked in on it. Have you?
I haven't either. I was going to wait until this weekend when things heat up a
little
bit. Right,
and then the finals are, you know, what, second week in June, third week in June? It's,
yes.
It goes on. The racing goes on for about a month.
But but it's very exciting. And to Larry Ellison's credit, the chairman of Oracle, he wants to take a basically 2.5-hour boring sporting event and turn it into a 25-minute Formula One racing. And now that these boats that used to go 13 knots are now going 55, 56 knots with these hydrofoils and everything else, it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, that's great. We'll tune into that at a later date. We have a cool story today, and it is pretty cool because we know not a lot about 3D printing. We do know that the first 3D printer was actually developed in the early 90s. Most of us, lay people, have only been aware of them for about, I don't know, the last 5 years or so.
Yeah.
Pretty incredible 3D printer now printing parts of a jet engine that, well, tell us a little bit about it. You're familiar with this story. Something that they had not been able to successfully create with welds and the other ways of manufacturing parts of a jet engine. This, in this case, it's a nozzle for dispensing fuel.
Well, GE Aircraft is a division of GE, General Electric, and they build aircraft engines. And their newest generation, latest generation engine, which is, they have so many orders for this. I think they have like a $150 billion backlog of orders, and it's going to take them years to fill it. Has a very complex part in it. It's a nozzle that distributes fuel to the engine. And the nozzle has a lot of welds. It's very difficult to build, and they've tried to cast it. It doesn't work. And there's so many pieces that have to go together in this very sophisticated nozzle that they haven't been able to manufacturing. So now with 3D printing, they can take this CAD drawing of this nozzle, send it to a computer, which is now able to layer upon layer build this complex part that would take a whole bunch of welds. Now there are no welds, and they can knock them out pretty quickly, and they can use much lighter materials.
So the fascinating thing about this to me is a 3D printer. We think, you know, in the most simplest of terms, they take a piece of plastic and they cut away. This technology is, they're applying an additive. It's a nickel alloy that they're adding to instead of taking away, which is in itself new technology.
Yes,
and it's called
layering.
Additive.
They'll be layering in this additive process, one layer on top of another as the part or the device takes shape, whatever they're building, including, I think they're printing human ears with 3D printing now.
It's just phenomenal. So this nozzle or this tip that disperses the fuel, it had more than 20 parts that needed to be welded and brazed together and everything, and that wasn't working. And now these 20 parts are one single unit. It's not 20 parts.
That's correct.
So way more effective, and it's really incredible.
And General Electric as a company is going to be investing heavily in additive manufacturing, this new piece to the 3D puzzle, and a number of other companies are as well. And our next guest, Dr. Andrew Shapiro from Jet Propulsion Laboratory, they have a product which they'll be using to make parts for spacecrafts, and I'll be curious to ask him if they're thinking about bringing maybe 3D printers with them on spacecraft. If anything breaks and you're 100 million miles from home,
you just
it
print
wouldn't
up
be a bad
one.
Idea to print a new part.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the human side of this story that I really like, the chief engineer at GE Aviation, Mohammed Etishami, I believe you say his last name. He was lived in a village. There was only one literate person in his village in Iran, and that was his mother. Now, his mother said that he must go to school. He must study science instead of working on the pistachio farm that the rest of the folks did in this little dusty village in Iran. And sure enough, he becomes a chief engineer at GE Aviation. That's a great story.
It is a great story. And, you know, the opportunities in science and technology and mathematics, it's just endless. And it's nice to hear that story, since, you know, you also hear stories where people are sort of not believing in science. So this is very encouraging.
Absolutely. Let's take a quick underwriting break, and we'll be back with our next guest, Dr. Andrew Shapiro. We're looking forward to talking to him about a moon called Europa when we return. Stay with us.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, celebrating 25 years in Park City. San Francisco Design is happy to sponsor public affairs programming. Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, celebrating 25 years in Park City. San Francisco Design is happy to sponsor public affairs programming on KPCW. For 25 years, we have been providing home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. We're located on Bonanza Drive and at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. We were just listening to that taped conversation that John had in Copenhagen with Captain Larson of the cruise ship, the Seabourn Quest, along with our cool story today about 3D printing. Our next guest is Dr. Andrew Shapiro. He was with us back in April discussing fascinating new concepts and projects receiving funding by NASA at the Jet Propulsion Labs in Pasadena, California. Dr. Shapiro is with us today to talk about Jupiter's moon Europa and the unique technologies that will be needed to explore her. Dr. Shapiro, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's really nice to have you. To ask you first, you know, what is the significance of Europa? There are many moons out there, and Europa is not the biggest one. In fact, it's quite small, a little smaller than our moon. What is important about it?
Well, Europa is a fascinating body in our solar system. It's about the sixth largest moon in the solar system and the 15th largest object in the solar system. But what makes it fascinating is the potential is the for life with the amount of water on Europa.
And so when you look at pictures of Europa, you see this object that looks like a moon, except it's got these striations and cracks all over it. So these huge striations or huge cracks, are they all from this surface ice crust of the moon?
Yes. Europa is covered completely in ice, and the thickness of the ice is an interesting scientific debate at the moment. Depending on which scientific group I talk to, it could be somewhere between 5 kilometers and 30 kilometers thick. But the striations that you see are thought to be primarily from an upheaval process, or essentially what would be equivalent of a plate tectonics process here on Earth, or like giant glacial movements on Earth.
Oh, that's fascinating. Dr. Shapiro, can you tell us a bit about Europa relative to the other 15 moons? And I understand that Europa is one of 4 Galilean moons, as they call them, because Galileo actually discovered Europa and the other 3 moons maybe back in the 1600s?
Yes. Galileo discovered this 4 moons, and he actually named them Jupiter 1 through 4, I believe. He discovered them in 1610. They're interesting. All the moons are locked in a tidal resonance. the tidal resonance of Europa is a 3.5-day orbit. And the tidal resonance means, like our moon, that one side is always facing the planet. And every 3.5 days, Europa circulates entirely around Jupiter. And Jupiter is a huge planet, so Europa is moving quite fast.
Okay, and can you tell us about your Europa job responsibilities? When we spoke to you back in April, we talked about some very exciting concepts and projects that JPL was starting up and getting funding for that you were responsible for overseeing. But you also have Europa responsibilities. Can you tell us about those?
Yes, well, that's an interesting question. My responsibilities for Europa are actually fairly indirect. My job is innovation in technology. And the reason that I'm looking at Europa at all is because it requires significantly new technology in order to do the exploration. And so if it were just a regular flight mission, I wouldn't be involved normally. But because it requires new technologies, we try to think of the kinds of things that are going to be needed in order to do the exploration and to ultimately search for life on Europa. So maybe it would help if I gave you a few of the characteristics of Europa, which you'll start to understand why it's such a challenge.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
So Europa is a very, very harsh environment on the surface. It's at about 100 degrees Kelvin. That's minus 173 degrees Celsius. So it's extremely cold. So most things that you usually use, say electronics or mechanisms, don't work at those temperatures. Electronics don't work primarily because of the batteries. If you've ever tried taking your cell phone out when you're on a ski trip at the top of a mountain, you'll see that it dies very quickly as soon as it starts to get cold. And the same thing happens with other batteries. We have some fairly high-tech batteries, for instance, but they are still only good to about minus 80 Celsius, not minus 170. So there's a technology gap there. Some of the other things that make it an extremely harsh environment are there's no atmosphere essentially whatsoever on Europa, which means you're staring straight into a vacuum, which means there's no kind of there are no molecules there to keep the spacecraft warm or to conduct heat away or keep anything protected. So you're just essentially looking out into the vacuum of space. A third thing that makes it a very harsh environment is it's an extremely high radiation environment. It's about let's see. The radiation environment is substantially more than Earth's at this point. And what happens is, I think I have did a calculation, it's about 77 times the radiation levels at Earth, which means it would be like being exposed constantly to, say, the X-rays you would have for a chest X-ray, but without any protection. And if you put electronics in that kind of environment, they also die very quickly because the X-rays tend to destroy the semiconductors that we use every day. So these offer some substantial challenges for the exploration of Europa.
Those are pretty big challenges. Good thing they have a guy like you to help overcome those challenges. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Shapiro, about, you know, some people who don't support the types of, space exploration and question the funding for it. I think that you can always go back to how it can be applied, how space exploration can be applied at home. And when you started talking about battery technology, I think that's something that is so great. It translates back to the layperson who's wondering about why their phone dies when they go out on the ski slopes. And I just wanted to mention that and ask you a little bit about battery technology, because as we know, my iPhone 7, boy, last winter when I was skiing and on those really cold days, about 5 degrees in Park City, the battery, the technology has advanced enough that it didn't die. So talk about what you do to advance that technology.
Well, what they've done in the cell phone industry and what we're doing even more so in the advanced spacecraft industry is we actually changed the chemistry of the battery itself. We changed the types of electrodes and we changed the types of electrolytes so that the real problem is that their ions carry the charge back and forth between the positive and negative electrodes there. Actually, in batteries, they go one way. Mm-hmm. The problem is at cold temperatures, the normal batteries that we use, those ions essentially freeze out. They just don't have enough energy to move across the barrier, and so they can't carry a current. With these new batteries that we've been working on, and some of the things in the cell phone industry, I think, are a spinoff, actually, from some of the work that's been done at NASA quite some time ago. They actually just changed the chemistry entirely so that they set up a situation so that the mobility of the ions and then the electrons as a result is much higher and can work at much, much colder temperatures.
Mm. Interesting. If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Andrew Shapiro of JPL in Pasadena, California. He's working on a project for NASA, developing technologies that are needed to explore Jupiter's moon Europa. And you're, of course, one of the many people that we speak to that sound like they love their job. They're fascinated by what you're doing. And talk to us a little bit about your original fascination with Europa. Was it because of the possibility of extraterrestrial life, or what was it?
Well, yes, and that and more. I thank you for mentioning that. I have to say I have one of the most fun jobs in the world, I believe, and so I enjoy it quite a bit. I just get to explore new technologies and see what they can do. And Europa offers several challenges. One of them, it is the most likely place, if we talk to most scientists, that we will find the possibility of life. And the reason that we can find the possibility of life in Europa is because there's liquid water underneath this ice crust. And scientists generally believe where there's liquid water, there's a good chance that life can develop if there's an energy source. Now, Europa is a little different on the energy source. And on Earth, our primary energy source is the sun. But as you're probably aware, there are some life forms that don't rely on energy from the sun. There are these vents at the bottom of the ocean that rely on geothermal energy as their energy source. And it's shown that those rely entirely on that and not at all from energy from the sun. And the situation can be very similar in Europa. It has three energy sources that are possible that could sustain life. One of them is it could be some geothermal energy at the floor. I think that's not so likely, talking to the scientists. The second possibility is there's a frictional energy from the ice sheets. And this frictional energy is generated because Europa is moving so quickly around Jupiter. And it has a very slight eccentricity to its orbit, about 0.01%. And with that slight eccentricity, what happens is that the ice sheets buckle and move against each other and cause friction. And the scientists think that any across the planet of Europa, ice could move up and down as much as 30 meters every 3.5 days. 30 meters, that's you know, nearly 100 feet. That's quite a bit. And the energy from this friction of the ice buckling because of this distortion of the planet, of the moon, is another energy source. And then the third energy source is the radiation from Jupiter itself. Now, if you have the radiation on the surface, that might be too much for life. And again, we don't know what kind of life could be there. But it's enough to generate the possibility of life, say, down in the snow, maybe a meter down below the surface, where the ice itself protects from the radiation, but there's enough energy for life to be sustained. So those are the reasons that make Europa particularly interesting in that aspect.
Dr. Shapiro, we have technology for evaluating soil samples and things that are right on the surface, but I don't know anything about the technology that would be required to break through the ice to get to the water. What sorts of things have you come up with at JPL?
Well, that's a great question. Maybe a little context is required at this point. There's currently one funded mission for the exploration of Europa, and that is something called the Europa Clipper. And the Europa Clipper is scheduled to launch in 2023, I believe, maybe 2024. And what it will do is orbit Jupiter in a highly eccentric orbit. The reason it has to be so eccentric is because the radiation fields are so high in Jupiter that it cannot stay in the Jupiter magnetic field for very long. So it kind of does quick passes and flybys, but it's designed to do flybys of Europa to do imaging, and it may get as close as 16 kilometers to Europa's surface with a whole suite of instruments to try to study what is exactly down there. We actually have very little information about precisely what's on the surface. So that would be the first mission, and that one is funded currently by Congress and is moving along quite well here at JPL. There's a second mission called the Europa Lander, which is not really a mission yet. It's a mission concept study, which means it hasn't been funded by NASA and Congress to its full mission status yet. It's undergoing a study, and that will be a lander that will land on the surface and have a mission life of about 20 days. And that one is really just to understand what's at the surface there. So that mission contains a few instruments that contain something. Well, the instruments haven't been decided yet because, again, it's just a study. So this is speculative at this point at best. But the kinds of instruments would be something like a seismometer. Because of these huge shifts in the ice sheet, they think they can detect a lot about how the ice is put together on Europa by some type of seismometer. A second would be a mass spectrometer, which will determine what kinds of elements are present and molecules are present on the surface, and then, of course, an imager. So that's the second mission. So with the information from those two missions, then we talk about how to get through the ice itself, because the interesting area is at the interface between the ice and the water. We think that that's the most likely place to find life that's interesting. And so the third mission, should we get that far, would be to actually go through the ice. And as you said, it's quite a challenge. There are four possibilities that we're looking at the moment, but I think there will be several more that come into play before we know enough information to down select to the one or two that are likely to go ahead with it. So okay. One way of going down is to actually use a radioactive generator, which is the same kind of thing that we use to power the current MSL mission. And that's just a heat source. It's not like a nuclear reactor or anything. It's just using the heat from a radioactive source, and it's insulated, so it's actually quite safe. You can handle it and that kind of thing, but it does generate heat. And we could use that heat to melt through the ice, so that's one possibility.
And just to interrupt you for a second, Dr. Shapiro, many of our listeners have seen the movie The Martian with Matt Damon, and there was a radioactive device that he used for staying warm. Are you talking about something similar?
That's precisely it. Yes, it would just be a variation on that exact device.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So, that's quite accurate. Another way you could possibly do it is to saw through the ice, use essentially a small blade and just actually chip your way through. A third way is to use a drill. And a fourth way is to actually use lasers to melt the ice in front of a probe going down. Now, keep in mind that this is quite a distance we're going. We're going probably 15 kilometers, say, is a good estimate. It really depends on the scientist you talk to how far we have to go. But it's still quite a distance. 15 kilometers is a substantial distance to go when you're very power limited. And so that's the real challenge for us.
You know, Dr. Shapiro, as I sit here listening to you, I can't help but think, as you're exploring new technologies and ways to achieve these seemingly insurmountable tasks on a moon of Jupiter, so very far away from us, does it ever give you pause, or does it ever make you think about how easy things are to accomplish here on Earth?
Well, what I tell my colleagues, often the technical problems are the easy ones. It's much more challenging to deal with organizations and funding and actually getting the ability to go execute the technical things we know how to do.
Oh, that's a pretty funny answer. I like that. I have to ask you if I did a road trip over the weekend, and I was listening to, catching up on podcasts of This American Life. I don't know if you ever listened to that.
I do.
And there was this episode all about Fermi's paradox and how sad that this radio producer felt about the possibility of there being no one out there, no extraterrestrial life, no one out there except us. And this real sadness that comes along with that. What do you think about Fermi's paradox?
Well, I look at it differently. I look at it from Drake's point of view, and if you're familiar with the Drake equation, Carl Sagan made it famous from his show The Cosmos many years ago. And I actually talked with Dr. Drake. He's on our NIAC board, and it's interesting. He did a calculation of what the probability of life would be. He said, and he did this before we knew a lot of the information that we know about exoplanets today. He says, you look at the number of stars, and there are roughly, I think, 10 to the 24th stars or something like that, which is quite a large number. It's roughly size of the number of atoms in a sugar cube, something like that. So that's a huge number. And you say, well, how many of those stars actually have planetary systems? And we look, and with Kepler now, we found that nearly every star system that we look at has planets. And so if we say if 1% of those, 10 to the 24th, has a planet that has the correct amount of energy, and as we've shown with the possibility of life in Europa, it doesn't have to be in what they call the Goldilocks zone, which is not too hot or not too cold. It could actually be further out if there are other energy sources that would sustain life. But even if we say conservatively that 1% of those is actually could sustain life, that means they're 10 to the 22nd. 10 to the 22nd planets that could sustain life, that have the conditions, that have water, that have energy. If you think about that, and maybe there are some kinds of issues that with even 80% of those or 50% of those, you still have, 10 to the 20th planets. 10 to the 20th is a huge number. So I think the probability of finding some kind of life on one of those is extremely high. Now, the real issue is what kind of life? And my expectation is that there would be some kind of microbial life. I don't think that the probability of finding humanoid life or super intelligent alien life is very high. But it's going to be very difficult to find out because I think the distances that you would need to communicate are quite large. Keep in mind that to talk to the nearest star, the round-trip message time is about 8 years.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's fascinating. And Dr. Shapiro, we were sending emails back and forth this week, and I was asking you about other new concepts or projects that have gotten your attention back at JPL that are going through a funding process. And we had the show, of course, back in April and heard a lot about these new technologies. But something came up that I had not heard of before, and that is Puffer. It's a miniature robot that will be able to do some exploration for us. Can you talk about Puffer, its size, and how it might be deployed?
Yes, Puffer is one of my most fun projects. It was the brainchild of a team of very young engineers here, maybe 5 or 6 years out of school, and they came up with this idea of an extremely small robot. The robot's about the size of an iPhone 7 when it's folded up, and it weighs much less. It only weighs, I think the current target mass is about 100 grams. So these are pretty darn small, little lightweight robots. And the idea would be to take a stack of them, and you could stack in a shoebox, you could fit probably 30 or 40 of them, and then drop them off from a larger rover or from a shell. So one concept that we've been looking at with the Puffer is to maybe attach it to something like the next Mars rover and then drop a stack of these, and they can scurry around and do some interesting things that we couldn't do with a larger rover. They have several capabilities that make them uniquely qualified. One is that they can fold nearly flat. When they're completely flat, they're about a centimeter high. I think about 2 centimeters high, they can actually move. And so, for instance, they can crawl under rocks, under overhangs of different types, and even they could drop down into caves. They're fairly robust, so you could drop them from several meters, and we've done this, and they work just fine. They're kind of flexible and can spring and bounce a little bit. So you could actually drop them down into a cave, and they could communicate back. What we've equipped the rovers with on our first round is a small microscope, and it uses the body of the microscope focus it. And the second thing that we had was the little navigation camera. So there's kind of a camera looking up and a camera looking down. The other thing that these can do is they can operate as a swarm, and so they can go explore behind rocks. They can look for things that might not be visible to the main rover, and they can communicate back if there's something interesting there, so the rover would decide to go to that area instead of some other area. So they can kind of probe things that are at a distance and not have to commit the entire resources of a large rover to something that may look interesting and you can't tell unless you've looked at it closely. They also have the capability of climbing up very steep angles. They have special wheels on them, and I'm not sure the video you saw probably doesn't have the latest version of the wheels, but these wheels can climb up a 45-degree incline or maybe even steeper. We had a field test just a couple of weeks ago out in the desert, and we tried these things. And so a rock that could not be easily accessed by the rover, you could actually crawl up the striations and image the striations of a rock going up at a very steep angle. And the scientists are very interested in that. And again, we can get science data that we couldn't get from a larger rover.
That's really interesting. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Dr. Andrew Shapiro is our guest, the manager of early stage innovation for the Space Technology Office at the California Institute of Technology and JPL, where he's currently responsible for several technology tasks for the potential Europa lander missions. Dr. Shapiro, thanks so much for joining us again on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Wow, interesting. And we want to thank our underwriter, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain. You're listening to KPCW Park City.